This is Law and Disorder. Welcome to Law and Disorder, and a happy new year to all of you for 2007. Some good news, some bad news. The good news is we're going to bring you three election observers who just recently came back from Venezuela, where they watched Hugo Chavez win an amazing landslide election. Good news for Venezuela, good news for South America, ultimately good news for all of us. Secondly, Goldman Sachs, an investment house in New York, they're getting $16.2 billion bonus. The bad news is, what are the rest of the people getting from that? You'll hear two special guests, an economist and a woman concerned and who has an organization on economic and social rights, tell us what that means. We'll have a spoken word performance from Professor Louie and Fast Eddie, who are joining us in the studio, an absolutely remarkable performance remembering Hurricane Katrina and its devastation. Stay with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We'd like to update listeners on some of the stories we've been covering over the past year. One of those stories, of course, is the Iraq War. We had a lot of hoopla last year about the Baker-Hamilton Commission, about getting Democrats into Congress, and of course, Democrats are starting to control the House and the Senate as of January 3rd and 4th of this year, when Nancy Pelosi will be sworn in as the new House leader, and you'll have a Democratic Senate by one vote, but a Democratic Senate nonetheless. The question in my mind has always been, what does that mean for the Iraq War? Sadly, it appears to be more of the same, if not more and more of the same. There's already been proposals out there to increase the number of troops in Iraq, more people around Baghdad, to increase the funding for Iraq, so that despite even the basically very modest proposals by the Baker-Hamilton Commission to begin to draw down troops and get us out of Iraq, that doesn't seem the direction that Bush is going, and sadly, it doesn't seem the direction that the Democrats are going as well. That tells us we're really still at the beginning of a very, very long fight to get us out of Iraq. That's one issue that we'll continue to cover over the next year. And of course, as the beginning of this year, the trial of Lieutenant Ouattara, remember him, the first officer who refused to go to Iraq, is supposed to begin in early January. We'll continue to bring you coverage of Lieutenant Ouattara's case. And then the issues that I've been particularly concerned by at the Center for Constitutional Rights, the issue of Guantanamo, torture, and trials of people in a manner that are really kangaroo courts. There's still around 400 people at Guantanamo. The administration has a proposal out there to build a new courthouse that will cost $125 million. Interestingly, in 5 years, they haven't tried anybody yet at Guantanamo, but some boondoggle they want to give to one of their friendly corporations to build a $125 million courthouse. Am I optimistic about Guantanamo? I can't say that I am. It's been 5 years since the Center for Constitutional Rights brought the first case to try and get rights for the people at Guantanamo. There's still 400 people or just under that at Guantanamo. And the administration doesn't seem to be going backwards. But in fact, with the Congress, they have twice now denied people the right to file writs of habeas corpus and test their detention. So we're still in a long struggle, a Sisyphus-like struggle, to try and close down Guantanamo and give people the rights they deserve. And then the other issue we've, of course, been covering for a number of years now is the issue of torture. And again, people probably remember in the Military Commission Act, they gave themselves a reverse amnesty, the administration did, a retroactive amnesty that said that they could not be prosecuted for the torture and cruel treatment that they carried out on people at Guantanamo and other secret sites from 9/11 forward. So that's one big issue that we're still trying to get at. And of course, they modified the definitions of torture and cruel treatment in Geneva so that they could continue to abuse people if they felt it was, quote, necessary going forward. So again, torture seems to be now part and parcel of how we treat people we pick up in the so-called war on terror. So we still have a long, long fight ahead of us. The change in the Congress will not necessarily foretell better things going forward, particularly in the issues that I've spoken about. Hopefully things won't get worse, although I'm not sure with what they've been saying about Iraq that we can be sure of that. Our obligation is clear that we have to fight for fundamental rights, for human rights, for all people at all times. There can be no stepping back on those issues. Thank you for listening to us here at Law and Disorder, and we expect and hope you will be with us for another year.
We have with us today three guests just back from Venezuela, Ming Alterman, Ellen Myers, and Judge Gustin Reichbach. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Judge Reichbach, you just came back from Venezuela a couple weeks ago after observing the elections down there. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you got interested in this and how you ended up in Caracas.
I am a Supreme Court judge. I sit in the criminal term in Kings County. And I've also worked with the United Nations serving on war crime tribunals in Kosovo. So I have an abiding interest in international law, international human rights, and I was part of a group of eight judges from around the country who were invited to go down along with 800 others to serve as international observers for the presidential election that was held in the beginning of December.
Ellen Myers, same question to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you down to Venezuela.
I have been working for most of my adult life in education, supporting public school teachers. I'm not sure it drew me down there, but what I can say is, having been down there, it is thrilling to be in a country where the two top priorities are education and health. So I felt like I was in a dream world. I went down there because Gus got an opportunity. Gus and I are married, and I grabbed it because there's nothing like being in the right place at the right time.
Ming Alterman, you got out of Wesleyan a year ago. I got out of the University of Wisconsin about 40 years ago, and instead of going to Venezuela, people who thought another world was possible were going down to Cuba. But what was it that led you down to Venezuela?
Well, I majored in Latin American history and spent my whole junior year in Argentina, so my affinity for South America and Latin America is very strong. The judges needed someone to help with the translation, and if I could pay my flight, they said I could go and be an unofficial delegate to observe, and so I jumped at the chance, to do that. It's, you know, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Being a history major and witnessing history and witnessing a momentous election, I wouldn't pass up that chance for anything in the world.
Judge Reichbach, I don't mean any disrespect, but in the interest of full disclosure here, we're friends. If you don't mind my calling you Gus.
Is that disrespectful of me to have you as a friend?
I'm not going to call you Your Honor anymore. No. I'm going to call you Gus.
That's quite okay. You've called me worse than that.
What was the mission of your group charged with when you went down to observe the elections?
Well, there have been three elections in recent times which have either reaffirmed President Chavez's presidency or passed the Constitution. At each term, the opposition has cried fraud. So I think the government, understanding, frankly, that it was way ahead in the polls, wanted to make sure there would be international observers from all over the world. The EU sent representatives. The Carter Center was there. OAS had representatives to make sure, to understand that they were using cutting-edge technology, to make sure the observers understood the technology and could certify, indeed the international observers did, that it was a free, fair, and transparent election. And it's interesting to note that even though it was anticipated, and there were rumors that the opposition had already printed 200,000 T-shirts before the election was held, and that denouncing it as fraudulent, in fact, in what I think is a very encouraging moment for Venezuelan democracy, this is the first election in which the presidential candidate for the opposition accepted the results of the election and, in fact, said that they were held correctly, appropriately, and fairly. It's really kind of a breakthrough because while these other elections have been certified as fair by the Carter Center and other groups, notwithstanding, they have been attacked politically, and it's notable that there was an absence of that attack, and indeed, I believe the American ambassador even acknowledged that the elections represented the will of the Venezuelan people.
And how would you describe the press down there? Is it any way controlled by the government all the way to the other end of the spectrum? Is it wild and woolly? Ellen Ming, jump in here on this.
There's one state-owned television station. The rest of the stations and the print media is in the hands of the opposition. This is quite something. It's quite stunning to be in a country that the majority of the people are completely supportive, and in some ways it seems they love their president, to have the media be so against the president. What Chavez does is he has his own show on Sunday, and the show goes something like 4 hours long.
Alo Presidente, it's where people call in and they talk to the president. And
what kind of majority did he get as a result of the elections?
Well, he got a 62% majority, which is over 7 million votes, and which was the most votes ever accumulated in by one candidate in a presidential election in Venezuela. Back to the media, you know, we know if anyone's seen The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, the documentary on the coup, which lasted 2 days in Venezuela, they know the majority of the media is against Chavez and against the Bolivarian Revolution. I sort of compared it to, you know, the United States media, where a lot of this media is more towards the right, and you have media outlets like Fox News manipulating truth.
Ming and I had the opportunity to meet with the editor of one of the opposition papers, and it was really interesting because while he's clearly not a Chavista, 40% of the people did not vote for Chavez. Everyone that we spoke to, including the editor of this opposition newspaper, concedes that no matter what they might think about Chavez, he has made terrific inroads in terms of literacy for his people and in terms of providing health care for his people. And we heard that directly from the editor of one of the opposition papers.
Am I correct that his opponent in the race had been a supporter of the coup attempt several years ago?
Well, you know, that's certainly the charge made against him. He denies it. I mean, there are pictures circulated. He certainly was associated with the same forces, whether or not he's directly implicated. Look, what's going on in Venezuela is, to date, essentially peaceful social revolution. Venezuela is a poor country. 80% of the people are poor. Chavez has the support of 80% of that 80%. So hence his 60-plus percent victory, which represents those figures. I mean, the rich class Venezuela and the small middle class is freaked out because for the first time there's a government operating at the service of the poor rather than the elite of the society. And obviously, Chavez's social programs are the beneficiaries not only of his politics, but also $70 a barrel oil. What's funny, I find, about the opposition, the hostility of America, is we can imagine if he was stealing the oil money and putting it in a Swiss bank, we'd have no objection to that. In fact, that's what, you know, the history of the Venezuelan oil industry in large part is. Instead, he's distributing that money to the poor, so that becomes troublesome.
Here at Law and Disorder, Judge Gustin Reichbach, Supreme Court, New York State, Ellen Myers, and Ming Altman, all three of them have just come back from Venezuela. Gus was part of a delegation of judges and attorneys that observed the elections down there. Ming, let me ask you this. You were probably one of the younger people that went down to observe this. If you had to sum it up in a nutshell, when people ask you, what'd you see down there, what would you tell them?
Well, I really saw a true form of democracy in, I guess, its purest form. You have all people, all sectors of society participating in the democratic elections. And we have what they characterize as participatory democracy, which is, as Gus mentioned before, the 80% of the lower classes actually now have power to have influence in the government. In 1999, Chavez passed a referendum to create a new constitution. And part of that was he encouraged all population to send in articles, suggested things that they wanted included, clauses that they wanted included in the constitution. So we met people who, when we were reading the constitution, was like, well, my friend included that, like, that article. And that's amazing to me, because we have all these constitutions in France, here in the United States, but who created those constitutions? It was majority, like, the aristocracy.
And Ellen Myers, you're a weekly host on the radio show on WHCR, Harlem Community Radio. I don't know whether you've talked about to your listening audience about this. Assuming that you are, what would you say in a nutshell of the experiences that you drew from going down there?
Well, what I'd say in a nutshell is, one, my partner on WHCR and I always talk about is how few people take the opportunity to vote in this country. Especially, she talks about in her community, how difficult it is to get people to vote. What I saw in Venezuela was, number one, you vote on Sunday. We vote on Tuesday. They vote on Sunday. It's a celebration. Everybody participates. Everyone gets out there. People are partying. People get online at 4 in the morning, even though the polls don't open to 6, because it's the thing to do. People enjoy being part of a community. We also saw voting machines that have a paper ballot. They're electronic machines. You say who you want to vote for. You're asked to confirm. It's all done with pictures. You confirm, and then a paper ballot comes out. You're looking on the machine, you look on the paper ballot, you deposit the ballot. It's all doable. What I found out is we live in the banana republic. They live in the democracy.
That's very funny. Gus Reichbach, you're one of the most well-liked and well-respected judges we have here in New York. And when you're walking down the halls of justice there in Brooklyn, one of the other judges, say, bumps up against you and says, where have you been? And what? Tell him, I've been in Venezuela. And they say, what'd you go down there for? What do you say?
Well, I think when we get past the initial facts of the election, what's important to address to both my colleagues and I think the American public at large is the question of authoritarianism, because this is certainly one of the labels that has been hurled at Chavez. And Chavez is a populist with all the positive and potential negative that carries with it in terms of a politics. But I think it should be apparent that certainly at this moment his commitment to democracy, because he was the duly elected president. There was a coup. 2 days later, the people restored him to the presidency. If he was interested in being a dictator or an authoritarian, that was his moment. It would have been easy at that point to invoke, as we're also too familiar with, the demands of the national security state and shut down the opposition newspapers, shut down the opposition TV. Jail members of the opposition party. None of that was done. The papers that supported the coup are still publishing, as are the television stations that during the 2 days of the coup shifted their programming to cartoons rather than news. Those stations still operate. So if there was a tendency for authoritarianism, that would have been the politically astute moment to do it, because it would have been, I suspect, supported by probably a majority of the Venezuelan people. He opted not to do that, and I think that that's very telling in terms of the strength of Venezuelan democracy and his commitment to it.
For the three of you, Ming Alterman, Ellen Myers, Judge Reichbach, Venezuela is not an all-white society. How did the three of you pick up on that question in Venezuela?
Well, I know we went to a dinner with some of the leading Afro-Venezuelan scholars and activists, and what they explained to us is, like the situation in Brazil, there was a popular perception that Venezuela was kind of this melting pot where everyone had a little Spanish in them, had a little African in them, had a little Indian in them. What we learned is that this idea was only brought forth to kind of deny indigenous and Afro-Venezuelan rights in terms of denying their identity. The same thing happened in Brazil, where there was a certain society and that it was perfect and that there was no racism because all these people are all mixed and, you know, there's just one Venezuelan race. And that's totally not the case. You go to Venezuela and you see that there is a huge population of Afro-Venezuelan people. And we met these people who were like, well, I can trace my bloodline back to, you know, my great-grandmother who were slaves and who came over and were farming cacao.
I would just add to that Chavez is not from the elite white class in Venezuela. So he's been difficult for the wealthy to take on many levels because he's been sort of in your face from the class of people that have been oppressed traditionally in Venezuela. And I don't speak Spanish well enough to know that when he speaks Spanish, it's not an elite form of Spanish. It's more of, you know, it's more local street Spanish. That's part of the reason why you're seeing such antipathy toward Chavez.
Ming Alterman, Ellen Myers, Gus Reichbach, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
We have something unusual for our New Year's broadcast. In the studio today, down here at WBAI in New York City, we've got Professor Louis and Fast Eddie, the poets of the street. Both of them were born, bred, and buttered in Brooklyn, the center of the universe. Louis has been rapping endless blues poetry, and I suppose since he was a couple years old. His mother, Rose, used to say, "You can't keep that boy quiet." He's here today with Fast Eddie on bongos, playing backup for the wonderful rhythms, Louis the Poet. Without further chatter by me, they're going to play a song on Katrina. I first heard Fast Eddie back on December 9th at the Lynn Stewart Holiday Victory Party. And that's when they performed the song. I was sitting next to Lynn Stewart. Here's Katrina.
It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was equal when the pain came, when the rain was over. Day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? You and me, we saw the pictures on TV. Judgment Day on land and sea, we saw the proof. Water rising to the roof, people in the attic, dead face down, couldn't even get outside to drown. Raw sewage, toxic waste, little kids scuffling for a place to lie down, couldn't pay for a way to get out of town. Motherless children forced to roam, no home but the Superdome. As we gazed through the haze, we saw who pays. Black bodies laying in the streets for days, in so many ways, disease and trash, fire and brimstone, smoke and ash, National Guard at the door of the store, M16s all over, where was the war, many thousand gone, does it mean what it seems, Judgment Day in New Orleans, it was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came, when the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? Now the Mississippi River rolls into town, right out the heartland, from Minnesota down, wheat, soy, cotton and corn, multinational agriculture, sure as you're born, then Kraft, Nabisco and General Mills take the grain from the plains and hills, and down in Louisiana the chemical plants come to the river like ants in your pants, petrochemicals for miles and miles, toxic waste in piles, down there in the Mississippi Valley, the people call at Cancer Alley, ships through the night, the headlight beams, billions in goods to the port of New Orleans, and these giant companies hold the keys to government subsidies, tax cuts and incentives, and they were very inventive. They changed the river flow, killed the wetlands below. The hurricane had a new place to go, and they made so much money it got kind of heavy, but they never spent the money to fix the levee on the white side. The water stayed down. They never fixed the levee on the black side of town. So before and after, like slave and master, this was a man-made disaster. You could blame the hurricane, but it's kind of a joke. The people died 'cause the levee broke. And in all the flood and deluge, all the blood you saw on the news, where were the boats, the cars and buses? Where was the food, water, doctors and nurses? Where were the cops and the army? I'll tell you calmly, front to back, Jack, the army was in Iraq. The Department of Homeland Security, here to protect you and me, waited 3 days before they'd say it was an emergency. No urgency there. They didn't care because it was poor people left behind to die. And if you don't mind, it's no lie, it wasn't that kind to also leave alone the people in the prisons and the nursing homes. So there was blood on the leaves and blood at the root. It was death and destruction wearing a business suit. And there is no doubt, when the people needed, they couldn't get out. And right now, Jim, we begin the next big sin. When the people need it, they can't get back in. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? Now from under the hell of the smell and the human waste, from under the dying and the sewer grates, from under the wreckage the rats crept through. Some have four legs and some had two. The president flew in his private jet. People noticed he hadn't been there yet, so days and days late, he stood by the gate in Jackson Square. TV cameras filled the air. He put on some pretty good acts, but we now know the facts. He gave no bid contracts to Halliburton, nobody yelled. Billion-dollar companies, he wished them well. All his friends had something to sell. Now the storm had passed. At last it was sunny. So from people dying, they made money. Trailers wasting in the sun. Millions for work that was never done. The same ones who caused the disaster. Out of the ash, trash, and plaster. Out of the crucifixion morgues where the people lie. Before the bodies would dry, those who let the levee crumble didn't grumble or stumble, but those who committed the sin watched the money roll in. And you heard them right, they told us in plain sight, this place is gonna be more white. Condos and co-ops, casinos and photo ops, all enforced by thousands of cops. So the big money came back, but if you're poor or black, you got a one-way ticket on a one-way track. Clickety-clack, hear the engine roar. It's a pity, but your own city can't use you no more. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white? So the heart and soul of the USA is getting down in the town of New Orleans today. The art of the music in your heart got its start on the Mississippi shore. Blues, gospel, jazz, throw wide the door. Buddy Bolden and Louis Armstrong, there is no way that they were wrong. So black and blue, you still hear the song. How long? Tell me, Lord, how long to save your soul on a Saturday night? To open your eyes to see the light through the flood and corruption, the blood and guts. What happens to New Orleans? it happens to us. If greed and money is number one, there'll never be enough for everyone. It's already begun right here today. Throw out everybody who can't pay, a real estate boom, $200,000 a room. You try to be decent and give, and in the place you're born, you can't afford to live. But through the rain sound, through the hurricane, we found thieves and killers in charge, and there is no doubt we are the only ones who can take them out. No matter where you roam, no one stands alone. We need a home, and we need that miracle once in a while, when people come together mile after mile. When you stand up for someone else, everything changes, including yourself. You won't be bored or ignored. It's the coming of the Lord. Unity is the one thing that we can't afford. When you feel New Orleans down in your soul, that trumpet in the morning might make you whole, 'cause there will be no rest till we bring the best out of the worst. When those who come last finally come first, not just in dreams, but by any means, when we all move together like kings and queens, we might swing once more down in New Orleans. It was thunder and lightning, fire and rain. Heaven was level when the pain came. When the rain was over, day turned to night. Were you rich or poor? Were you black or white?
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Today we're going to do something a bit different on Law and Disorder. Normally we talk about civil and constitutional rights. Today we're going to talk about something rarely talked about in the United States, economic and social rights. We don't just have a right to be free from torture, we also have a right to make a decent living, to have good health care, good schools. Today in particular we're going to discuss the $16.2 billion bonus that the investment banking house of Goldman Sachs in New York City announced for its employees just before Christmas. And our own Michael Smith will talk to two people about this: Professor Rick Wolf, formerly the head of the economics department at the University of Massachusetts. He is currently the NASDAQ professor of economics at the New School. And Kathy Albisa. She's the head of an organization called NESRI, the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. She, in particular, is concerned by economic and social rights as a legal matter.
Kathy Albisa, Professor Richard Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The thing that so startled, I think, anybody that opened up the New York Times last week and then again the week after and then again just a couple of days ago was this continuing story on how the investment banking house of Goldman Sachs made so much money last year, their
holiday bonus to their partners and employees was $16.2 billion. Not million, billion dollars. The thousand million. $16.2 billion. Here on Law and Disorder, we wanted to explore not just moral underpinnings of that sort of inequality of wealth, but the legal ones as well. Kathy Alvisa, what was your reaction when you saw those New York Times stories?
Well, it did in fact make me think that we're sort of regressing back to both an economic and legal historical moment in time, sort of pre the Great Depression in this country, where capital was completely unregulated, where you had extraordinary disparities once we hit the Depression, and where there was no basic protection for economic and social rights.
Well,
and
what does the United Nations have to say about economic and social rights?
Well, in fact, from that experience, with the U.S. taking a strong leadership role, along with the experiences in World War II, came a crucially important document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which protects civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights as interdependent and fundamental. And those rights include the ones we know of as our own constitutional rights, like speech and freedom of religion, etc. But it also includes at least six primary economic and social rights, those being health, education, adequate food, decent work, housing, and health.
Rick Wolf, what was your reaction when you opened up the Times, saw that first article on the $16.2 billion bonus?
Basically, for me, it was the capstone, the finishing touch on a period of now 30 years in the United States in which, as Kathy correctly says, all of the New Deal attempts to bring some sort of reduced inequality was given up. And for the last 30 years, it's been plunder and grab and get at the highest levels of the American economy, almost as if they understood that this is a special period when the kind of grabbing of wealth you had 100 years ago, associated with names like Rockefeller and Carnegie and Mellon, you haven't been able to do that for 100 years. Here's another chance for the next century's old rich people of America to become that, people with the good luck to be in a certain position to be able to walk away with stupefying amounts of money when nobody was either looking or in a position politically to stop them.
Kathy, what would the equivalent be of $16.2 billion if it was to be used for housing or health or even just wages for people?
Well, there are a great many human rights crises, one could call them, in this country that could be resolved even or certainly improved with those kind of resources. And what's important to recognize about that sort of extreme concentration of wealth is that it's not just that. It has repercussions for ordinary people on the other end. Whenever you see that kind of extreme concentration of wealth, you also see all kinds of social instability and insecurity, as we are seeing in this country today, with increasing numbers of people without access to basic health care, with people in inadequate housing rising at extreme levels, and the indicators of child poverty not improving, etc., wages stagnant. I mean, the indicators are endless. And what's important to remember, those two things are tied. It's not just the inequality. It's that the inequality represents a failure to protect basic rights of the vast number of people.
Where does that kind of money come from? It doesn't grow on trees. I mean, my notion was if somebody's got a lot of money, somebody else doesn't have much. I mean, it's like a zero-sum game, isn't it?
Well, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But every time workers push for higher wages, the corporate executives, whose job it is, explain to the public that the reason they don't give the workers the higher wages is because if they did that, then everybody who bought the products would have to pay more in prices to pay for the wages. And so much as they would like to help the workers, they really can't because of their concern not to damage the ultimate buyer of the commodities they produce. These same corporate presidents don't make that argument when it comes to their own salaries. But the argument applies equally. If you pay your managers, as Mr. Blankfein of the Goldman Sachs is now getting, a bonus of $50-odd million for the year.
$51.5 million.
Yes. Huge amount of money. That, too, will be paid for. you're going to have to recoup the companies that either Goldman itself and what it charges, or the companies that hire Goldman and who have to get more money for the products they make to pay Goldman to do what they want Goldman to do. But sooner or later, that money shows up in the higher prices people pay. So the illusion that is so carefully cultivated among the American working people, this is a huge sum of money paid to these managers for the good work they do and is nothing to do with you, is a mistake. You will pay more for your Rice Krispies and your Coke and your hamburger. All of those things are produced by companies that hire Goldman Sachs, and what they must pay to Goldman is higher because Goldman executives are walking away with $50 million. So your hot dog will cost you more, pull more money out of your pocket because these people are drawing this kind of a salary.
What about the just abysmal conditions, not just for people in the United States, but in countries where people are making a dollar or two a day? How would $16.2 billion going into the hands of a handful of Goldman Sachs people affect people, say, in Kenya or the Philippines? And what's life like for them there?
Like, you know, you don't even have to go that far. In Florida, in the last 10 years, there have been 6 federal prosecutions of slavery, freeing thousands of workers, farm workers. And that's in Florida. The reason that slavery is a problem in Florida is because farm workers' wages have been stagnant for over 25 years. Sometimes the only way they can turn a profit, the growers in Florida, is to enslave their workers. That, in part, has to do with the concentrated buying power of big purchasers like McDonald's, like Walmart, who've been pushing down wages for all these decades. The growers, who are no saints because they've participated in this process, are actually not the ones making the profits if you look at the numbers. It's the big purchasers. And here you have farm workers making $7,000, some as low as $2,500 a year. You have regular incidents and regular prosecutions of slavery. In fact, there's one that's ongoing now that's been recently reported. So you don't even have to go that far to see that kind of destitution. Just go to Immokalee, Florida. Just call the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida and ask them what they've been battling down there for the last 10 or 15 years.
And how does that impact internationally, Rick?
Let me give you, an example of the kind of calculation that you need to make. The numbers are actually much larger than the $16 billion because that's just what one large company does. Merrill Lynch does the same thing. Lehman Brothers does the same thing. All of the large financial corporations, and indeed many of the non-financial, that is the companies that produce things. Perhaps later we can talk about another story in the New York Times you may have seen, in which the ex-president of the Pfizer drug company, one of the largest American corporations, a guy named Hugh McKinnell, was given a severance package at the end of this year because this is the last year that he was the president of the company. His severance package was $200 million, 4 times what Mr. Blankfein got as his bonus. He got that, and now he has $200 million, which come from the Pfizer drug company, which will have to recoup that money by charging more for all the medicines that everybody uses. Indeed, it's all I can do not to make the obvious suggestive joke, since Pfizer is the producer of Viagra, and it would lend itself to all kinds of humor. In any case, let's go back to Goldman Sachs. They are an investment banker. That is, they arrange for mergers between companies. When a company wants to buy another company, they will hire Goldman Sachs and so on. Many companies active in the third world, in the less developed part of the world, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, will turn from time to time, because they have to Goldman Sachs to arrange for advantageous mergers, say, for government enterprises that are producing resources and so on. In other words, all over the less developed part of the world, governments and enterprises hire Goldman Sachs all the time and pay these enormous fees.
And what's also worth looking at is not only how much they're paying in form of these bonuses, but also that other aspects of our legal and policy infrastructure emphasize and deepen these inequalities. When you look at where we've been moving with our tax policy for the last number of years, not only are people making much larger sums of money in a very narrow slice of society, they're actually paying less into society. So they're getting all this from society, because I think it was Roosevelt who said, none of us could survive a day without at least 1,000 others, right? We're an interconnected economic system. Somebody puts the food on your table, somebody makes your furniture. None of these guys could survive a day without at least 1,000 others, probably many thousands given how they live. But the point is that they're getting an enormous amount from society, and they're being asked less and less of each day. The difference in poverty, for example, between Europe and the United States is not so much the difference in wages. What's different, if you look at the numbers, is the way the benefits and tax structure works. In the European systems, and unfortunately the move there is now away from that, but in the European system there's actually a lot more government investment in social well-being. And what we've done is we have lessened and lessened our investment in our social well-being, demanded less of the people who are in fact receiving most from society, and put ourselves in this very raggedy place in terms of our social infrastructure and economy.
Unlike Europe, working people in the United States don't have their own political instrument. They've got the Democratic Party that tries to pose as a friend of theirs, but in fact isn't. You see nobody in the Democratic Party, for example, complaining about the Goldman Sachs bonuses, because Goldman Sachs is one of the big funders of the Democratic Party. It was his investment banking houses, after all, that were the main backbone of the Clinton years, and probably be coughing up the bread for Hillary if she runs next time. Rick Wolf and Kathy Albisa, who are our guests here at Law and Disorder, I wanted to ask you what the effect of this is internationally, because these investment banking houses like Goldman Sachs or Merrill are not just national entities. They really have tentacles that go around the globe.
Well, much of what they do as enterprises is organize, merge. In a sense, they are the top of the pyramid. Their job is the kind of global organization of this phase of capitalism as a system. I think we should see that the kinds of fees they draw and the bonuses they pay reflect that role that they have. It's a moment in world history when capitalism feels itself as a system to be triumphant, to be unchallenged in the way that it was thought they might have been by the Soviet Union and China before. And so this is the moment in which to grab it all, since no one knows how long this lucky phase, if I can put it that way, will last. And so everything is, in a sense, subordinated to this drive for as long as it lasts. And I think the implicit part of your comment is correct, that this will last as long as the mass of people permit it. Not longer, but that long. And until there is a reaction, you won't see this change. In the nature of capitalism to produce profits, to compete to make more and more profits, we have nothing to be surprised about. Capitalism as a system for the 300 years it's been around has done this repeatedly. It's produced these booms. It's produced these bubbles. It's produced these cycles. It's produced these moments of incredible profit and inequality, and then it has had a crisis thereafter. And in each case, it's a question of whether the mass of people, the ones who ultimately produce this wealth, will they bring this to an end? Will they demand that the government step in and make it less harsh, as in the New Deal with Roosevelt? Or will they perhaps one day go one step further and ask whether or not a system that keeps producing this problem every so many years isn't what itself ought to be challenged and questioned?
I just want to pull back that question a little bit to the legal framework through which these things happen. Amartya Sen, who, as you know, is a very well-known and prize-winning economist, he says that market forces can be seen as operating through a system of legal relations, right? So these things don't happen in a vacuum. They happen within a system of legal relations. And what you see on the global scale is, in a sense, two competing system of legal relations. You have the one that is, one might say at this point in time, although in theory legally binding, you could still say it's aspirational, which is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the even the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
The last time we had an intense concentration of a wealth grab on the scale we have now was at the end of the 19th century. And in reaction, the mass of American people who were as grossed out then as I think Americans are becoming now, there was a reaction. And in 1910, for the first time in American history, an income tax, federal income tax law was passed. And if you go back and you read that law, you will discover that only the top 4% of Americans were to be paying any tax at all. It was a tax on the richest, those who had so much that the government coming to tax a small portion of it would not affect them, but would give the government resources it could use. Over the years, the rich went to work to shift the burden of the income tax from themselves to the mass of Americans. But even as late as the 1970s, the top bracket, that is the level of income tax, the rate paid by the people at the top, was 91%. That means Mr. Blankfein, had he earned this money 35 years ago, would have had to pay out of his $50 million, 45 of them, to the government for its social programs as his income tax. Kathy's quite right. In the last 30 years, along with everything else, those income tax rates have been dropped drastically by more than half, leaving Mr. Blankfein and all the others with these bonuses to walk away with enormous amounts of money that otherwise would have enabled the government to provide social programs. So it is indeed a political, legal question whether to permit and allow this kind of grotesquerie to go on. But if I could make another point, I think working people are going to have to face a difficult and painful fact. When you react, as we did in 1910 with the income tax, and as we did again later with a high rate of income tax to try to get the wealthy, they have the means, the organization, and the desire to escape the results of the upsurges by working people to get the law changed. Sooner or later, it's going to have to be necessary to raise the question, if all we do is react when capitalism spins out of control with some government laws and rules which they can then undo, then the only solution is to change their capacity to do that, to raise the question, how is a corporation, an enterprise, organized? Will it always be organized by a mass of people who produce a profit that a small number of people grab into their hands? Or are we going to change the basic structure so we don't face this cycle of wealth accumulation, reaction of a law to try to stop it, the undoing of that law, and then the whole process over again? Over the last 10 years, as 20 million people have seen the real value of what they get go down because the minimum wage stays the same but prices go up, has been the year when the wealthy have become relatively more wealthy at a pace we have not seen for 100 years. That's a society that is willing to watch the decimation of the mass of people who have little or nothing side by side with the explosion of the wealth of those who already have more than they can spend. And we watch it. And we observe it. And the only reaction I see, especially at the upper level, is actually revealed in the New York Times of Wednesday, December 27th, in which a little story appears that on the last hour of the last business day before the Christmas vacation, that's last Friday, the Securities and Exchange Commission reversed a rule it first passed last July requiring corporations to publicly reveal what they're giving in all the compensation for their top executives. So they, too, understand they need to control the perception. So they got the Securities and Exchange Commission to relieve them from the obligation of making it public.
Kathy Albisa, tell our listening audience, because it's really terrific the kind of work you're doing. Give us in a nutshell, will you, what your organization is all about. You founded it because it addresses itself exactly to what Rick has just been describing.
Yeah. The National Economic and Social Rights Initiative was founded in 2004. We describe it as promoting a human rights vision in the United States. And what we mean by that is a rights vision that includes economic and social rights that not only ensures basic needs for everyone, but also allows every person to develop their full potential. Because economic and social rights really aren't just about not starving, right? They're about allowing people to develop themselves, to protect basic dignity, et cetera. And because we believe that the only way you can support real change is through movement building. and from the ground up. What we do is we support community organizers who are working towards incorporating that human rights perspective into their social justice campaigns. And there's been increasing interest in human rights as a vision for social justice advocacy in the United States over the last few years.
If our listeners will get a pen or a pencil, can you give it to them, please?
Oh, sure. NESRI, NESRI.org. And let's educate ourselves as to why we got into this situation. There's no time to get into this now, but the unraveling of economic and social rights in America has a big, race has a big piece of that history. It's just something to keep in mind. I would urge everyone to read Eyes Off the Prize by Carol Anderson, which explores how race and economic and social rights have this bad chemistry experiment together in the United States.
Kathy Albisa, Rick Wolf, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
You know, we're dealing with a very critical and crucial time. Most crucial and critical time that I've ever witnessed. Being as young as I am, you know. We all don't want to say nothing else, so we say as young as we are. Now I want to talk about the pronunciation and the realization. Now, the educators, they call it ESP, positive thinking, right? Some of the people on the cross other side of the pond call it vibes, vibrations, astrology, and all those different things, you understand? But I call what it is what it is. What it is what it is. Look at him. Now you see, a brother, you take in the ghetto, you find a whole lot of crime. I can understand, hey, I know what it means. Being 9 years old before I got my first pair of underwear out of a store. You know, putting on a half pressed suit from the pawn shop with tennis shoes, trying to be hip. I know where it's coming from. Like the fella say, having catfish head stew. And then like the catfish went in there with his head and come out very quick and didn't leave nothing else. Now it's one thing the educators and the politicians and the establishment gotta remember. Now brothers need jobs. If you don't work, you can't eat. You don't work, you can't eat. Get hip to yourself, good God, my brother, get it from the street. You don't work, you can't eat. Sis, you don't work, Lord, you can't eat. So you got to have mind power to deal with starvation. And that's what we're dealing with. You see, we can't go back to the biblical stories, two loaves of bread. Or two little fishes, five loaves of bread. Two little fishes, yeah. Five loaves of bread. Now look here, too many brothers to go by that. Now I want your brothers to dig where we're coming from. Set your mind right here. Dig the JBE experience. I dug this from a young man out of New York. He said the GBE. Now we want to take it to the...